buzzing inside my head. I like communicating with our community. The station and I work together to make sure that I can take best advantage of the hearing I've got with proper equipment and a good studio environment. From the front door to the heart of the station, our volunteers have full access. Accessibility. It's yet another way that community radio brings out the best in us. Hashtag accessible radio.
Do you prefer tea or coffee? Indie, folk, rock, electronic, I've got it all. Tune in to What's Brewing Tuesdays from 7:30 to 8 a.m. for the freshest Canadian music to pair with your morning brew. Listen in as I chat over a cup of something fresh and talk about my favorite new releases from Canadian artists that I love. Nothing like good music and good coffee to start your day, so tune in to see What's Brewing.
Democracy Now.
The Trump administration, led by Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, is really making a play for Latin America. Venezuela, sure, there's oil, and that's important, but there's a lot of ways to get oil. But what's really at stake is getting Latin America organized, like moving on from Venezuela. They see Venezuela as the first step into a larger restructuring of the politics of the hemisphere. Venezuela would be first, then Cuba, then Nicaragua, and then isolating Brazil and Mexico.
As President Trump orders a complete blockade of sanctioned oil tankers coming and going from Venezuela, we'll speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin. He says Trump's dated strategy is putting us on a path to World War III. Then Chile's elected its most right-wing president since Augusto Pinochet.
We will tirelessly work to recover calm, order, growth, and hope, because Chile has demanded something that doesn't allow excuses. Chile wants a change.
We'll look at the election of far-right politician Jose Antonio Kast with the renowned Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman. He calls the election a political and ethical earthquake. We'll speak to him in Santiago. Plus, how did Jeffrey Epstein become rich?
How did Jeffrey Epstein have the financial backing to abuse what turns out to be hundreds of young women and girls through months of reporting and digging through documents?
People's diaries, letters, old photo albums.
The answer is he stole it.
We'll speak to New York Times reporter David Enrich about his new piece, Scams, Schemes, Ruthless Cons, the untold story of how Jeffrey Epstein got rich. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump ordered a blockade on sanctioned oil tankers going to and from Venezuela Tuesday, ramping up his threats on President Nicolas Maduro. In a post on social media, Trump said, quote, Venezuela's completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America. It will only get bigger, and the shock to them will be like nothing they have ever seen before, unquote. Last week, the U.S. seized a tanker in the Caribbean Sea that was carrying Venezuelan oil for Cuba and China. Since September, the U.S. military has been carrying out airstrikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific near Venezuela, killing at least 95 people in 25 attacks without showing evidence of drugs. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Tuesday there are no plans to release the full unedited video showing a deadly second strike on a boat on September 2nd. Legal experts and human rights groups have described the strike on two survivors clinging to the wreckage of the boat as a war crime. This comes as Trump's chief of staff, Susie Wiles, suggested in an interview with Vanity Fair that the U.S. military attacks on alleged drug boats aim to ultimately topple President Maduro. Wiles said, quote, Trump wants to keep on blowing boats up until Maduro cries uncle. And people way smarter than me on that say that he will, unquote. This is Maduro speaking yesterday in Caracas.
We tell the people of the United States our truth, and it is very clear. Imperialism and the Nazi fascist right wing want to colonize Venezuela to take our wealth, oil, gas, gold, iron, aluminum, and other minerals. We have sworn to defend our homeland, and in Venezuela, peace will always prevail, along with stability and shared happiness for our people.
President Trump is planning to give a primetime address to the nation tonight. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. In Gaza, Al Jazeera reports a two-week-old infant has frozen to death as winter storms batter the territory, and Israel continues to block the entry of shelter and other humanitarian supplies for the hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians forced to live in makeshift tents or buildings damaged by Israeli bombs. Meanwhile, in another violation of the U.S. brokered truce, Al Jazeera reports Israeli forces killed at least one Palestinian in the last 24 hours. This comes as efforts to recover the remains of the last Israeli hostage in Gaza have been hampered by the heavy rains. The International Criminal Court has rejected Israel's bid to block an investigation into war crimes committed by Israel in Gaza. In more related news, Axios reports the White House sent an angry private message to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu following the killing of Hamas senior commander Raed Saad, which Trump officials said violated the U.S. brokered ceasefire that went into effect in October. Netanyahu is scheduled to meet Trump at Mar-a-Lago at the end of the month as tensions rise around the implementation of the next phase of the agreement with Hamas. In Sydney, Australia, the first funerals were held today for victims of the Bondi Beach massacre, including for Rabbi Eli Schlanger and Rabbi Yaakov Levitan. Meanwhile, authorities announced one of the gunmen, 24-year-old Navid Akram, has been charged with 59 offenses, including murder and terrorism. The other gunman, his father, Sajid Akram, was shot dead by police at the scene. Here in the United States, in Rhode Island, the manhunt for the gunman who killed two students and injured nine others at Brown University Saturday has entered its fifth day. Authorities released a new photo, enhanced videos, and a video timeline showing a person of interest movements in the hours leading up to Saturday's shooting. One shooting victim remains in critical condition. Two have been discharged from the hospital. Six others are in stable condition. All classes and exams have been canceled. The campus remains on edge. This is Parth Gupta, a senior at Brown.
Brown was honestly one of the happiest IBs. That's how it was always known. But now, after everything that's happened, it's kind of become extremely scary. As a senior, having seen 3 years at Brown, like, I don't even know how this incident is going to change campus. It's very scary to go back, and it's extremely unfortunate to see what happened to a place like Brown.
An MIT professor was fatally shot at his home in Brookline, Massachusetts. Authorities have opened a homicide investigation into the killing of 47-year-old Nuno Loureiro, who was the director of MIT's Plasma Science and Fusion Center. In January, President Biden had awarded the Presidential Early Career Award for scientists and engineers to Professor Loureiro. In an explosive set of articles in Vanity Fair, journalist Christopher Whipple, author of a book on chiefs of staff, conducted 11 interviews with President Trump's chief of staff, Susie Wiles, over the course of a year. Wiles characterized President Trump as having an alcoholic's personality and said she urged him not to pardon the most violent rioters from the January 6th insurrection. In the interview, she says she thought Trump's efforts to go after his political enemies would end after 90 days and mentioned his campaign against New York Attorney General Letitia James, quote, may look like retribution. Wiles also said Vice President J.D. Vance has, quote, been a conspiracy theorist for a decade and called Russell Vogt, the budget director, a right-wing absolute zealot. She also called Elon Musk an avowed ketamine user and blasted his dismantling of USAID, saying, quote, no rational person could think the USAID process was a good one. Nobody, she said. On immigration, Susie Wiles said, quote, I will concede we've got to look harder at our process for deportation, unquote. Wiles also criticized Attorney General Pam Bondi's handling of the Epstein files, saying, quote, she said that the witness list or client list was on her desk. There is no client list, and it sure as hell wasn't on her desk, unquote. Meanwhile, the deadline for the Justice Department to release the Epstein files is set for Friday, December 19th. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he will not call for a vote to extend Affordable Care Act health care subsidies that are set to expire at the end of the year. As a result, millions of U.S. residents will have to pay higher health insurance premiums starting in January. Republican Congressmember Mike Lawler of New York said, quote, everybody has a responsibility to serve their district to their constituents. You know what is funny? Three quarters of people on Obamacare are in states Donald Trump won, Lawler said. Some House Republicans have signaled they would join Democrats in passing a discharge petition to force a House vote on a clean three-year extension of the subsidies, but that's unlikely to get a floor vote until next year. President Trump signed an order expanding his travel ban into the U.S. with partial or full restrictions to nationals from at least 20 additional countries, including Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, South Sudan, and Syria. The Trump administration's also fully restricted travel into the U.S. for people holding Palestinian Authority travel documents. In related news, the New York Times reports the Trump administration's transferred 22 Cuban immigrants to the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba. The men are believed to be the first Cuban citizens to be sent to Guantanamo since Trump returned to office and began his mass deportation campaign. It's estimated ICE has detained over 700 immigrants at Guantanamo this year. In news from Sudan, the UAE-backed paramilitary Rapid Support Forces has been attempting to cover up its mass killings of civilians in the city of Al-Fashir by burning and burying bodies. That's according to a new report by Yale's Humanitarian Research Lab, which analyzed satellite images depicting RSF fighters likely disposing of tens of thousands of remains following its capture of Al-Fashir, the capital of North Darfur, in October. At least 1,500 people were killed in just 48 hours after the RSF seized the city. The report said, quote, this pattern of body disposal and destruction is ongoing, unquote. This comes as over 100 civilians were killed in drone attacks on the Kordofan region, where fighting between the RSF and Sudanese military has intensified. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced as warring parties shift focus toward Kordofan. UN experts describe Sudan's war as the world's largest humanitarian disaster. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, M23 leaders say they've agreed to withdraw from the key town of Uvira in the eastern DRC at the request of the Trump administration. This comes just days after Secretary of State Marco Rubio condemned the city's capture last week, saying it violated a U.S. brokered truce signed by Rwandan President Paul Kagame and DRC leader Felix Tshisekedi earlier this month at a ceremony in Washington, D.C., hosted by Trump. M23 fighters are not signatories of that deal and have been involved in parallel peace talks led by Qatar. Rwanda has been repeatedly accused of backing M23. In related news, Human Rights Watch reports at least 22 civilians were killed and scores more injured in attack by militia fighters in late November on a territory in the western DRC. As ethnic conflicts rise in the region, HRW said in a statement, quote, the global focus on the peace accords in eastern Congo shouldn't distract from the unchecked violence and injustice and the cycles of impunity in other areas. In India, authorities are mandating all private and government employers to direct staff to work from home, and schools have canceled in-person classes as dense, toxic smog has engulfed New Delhi, pushing dangerous pollution levels to a record high. Healthcare officials have advised residents to avoid all outdoor activities and to wear a mask, as hospitals have reported a rising number of people suffering from breathing conditions and eye irritation. The toxic haze has also affected visibility, impacting travel with dozens of flights and trains delayed. This is a tourist who is stranded in New Delhi.
Visibility is very low. I can't see anything. We reached here by car yesterday due to fog and pollution. We could not see anything. We came to India Gate, but we can't see it. We can hardly see it as we have come closer. Pollution is also affecting my health a lot.
Greece's parliament approved a new budget Tuesday as massive protests were held by farmers and public sector workers denouncing low wages and skyrocketing food and housing costs. Earlier on Tuesday, protesters gathered in Athens.
We are striking today across the entire public sector and coordinating with the struggle waged by farmers against the government's passage of this budget. It is a budget that cuts millions from public hospitals, where I also work, and channels the money into military spending. It hands it to the banks. We will not allow this.
And Warner Brothers Discovery is reportedly rejecting Paramount Skydance's $108 billion hostile takeover bid to acquire the company. On Tuesday, Affinity Partners, which is run by President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, backed out of Paramount's deal. The move paves the way for Netflix to go ahead with its $83 billion bid for Warner Brothers. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump has ordered a total and complete blockade of sanctioned oil tankers entering and leaving Venezuela as the U.S. ramps up pressure on the government of Nicolas Maduro. The blockade comes amidst a major U.S. military buildup in the region and days after the U.S. seized an oil tanker filled with Venezuelan oil. In a post on Truth Social, Trump wrote, quote, Venezuela's completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America. It will only get bigger, and the shock to them will be like nothing they have ever seen before, unquote. Since September, the U.S. military has also carried out at least 25 airstrikes on alleged drug boats without offering evidence in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific near Venezuela, killing at least 95 people. On Tuesday, Vanity Fair published excerpts of bombshell interviews with Trump's chief of staff, Susie Wiles, in which she suggested the aim of the boat strikes is to topple Maduro. Wiles said, quote, Trump wants to keep on blowing boats up until Maduro cries uncle and people way smarter than me on that say that he will, unquote. On Tuesday, President Maduro denounced the U.S. actions.
We tell the people of the United States our truth, and it is very clear. Imperialism and the Nazi fascist right wing want to colonize Venezuela to take our wealth, oil, gas, gold, iron, aluminum, and other minerals. We have sworn to defend our homeland, and in Venezuela, peace will always prevail, along with stability and shared happiness for our people. To the people of the United States, we say again and again, one and a thousand times.
No blood for oil. No war for oil. Eso del narcotráfico.
The claims about drug trafficking are fake news, a lie, an excuse. Since they cannot accuse us of weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, or nuclear missiles, they invent another pretext to create another Afghanistan, another Libya. And with moral authority and with God's blessing, I say,
no more Vietnam, no more Afghanistan, no more Libya, no more Iraq. No more war eternal. No, 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 no.
We know we are morally and spiritually in the right.
We're joined now by the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, Yale University professor Greg Grandin. His latest book, America, America, A New History of the New World. He has a recent piece in the New York Times headlined, Trump's dated strategy is putting us on a path to World War III. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Grandin. Can you start off by responding to what's happening right now? We are doing this broadcast before President Trump makes his address to the nation tonight. Unclear what that's about. But talk about the latest developments with Venezuela.
Well, it is an unprecedented military buildup. It's probably bigger than what the Spanish Empire sent to retake Spain in the 1820s in terms of sheer destructive force, and the classification of fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction, and all sorts of presidential announcements that, you know, trying to lay a legal justification for this. And of course, as this is going on, they're still blowing up speedboats in the Caribbean and the Pacific. And as you mentioned, Susan Wiles, the secretary, the chief of staff of Trump, said that this had nothing to do with narco-terrorism, that Trump actually doesn't really care about narco-drugs coming into the country. This is really just setting up and hoping to induce a regime change in Venezuela. And Venezuela is really just the first step. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State from Florida, from South Florida, whose family is not itself is not uninvolved in drug trafficking, sees it in very ideological terms. He's Cuban, and for whatever reason, they see Venezuela as the first step of finally bringing down the Cuban Revolution and bringing Cuba back into the orbit of the United States. And then from there, of course, it's Nicaragua. And we just saw this election in Chile, which I know you're going to talk about later with Ariel Dorfman. But Latin America really is on a kind of knife's edge between the left and the right. We see in Argentina, Javier Milei, and what the United States is willing to do to keep him in power, billions and billions of dollars, not just through the Treasury Department, but also through the IMF to prop up the peso. Honduras, there's all sorts of machinations going on there in terms of the election that the U.S. was involved in. And so that really leaves Latin America divided, almost unprecedentedly divided. In the past, Latin America tended to be coherent, and I tend to be all dictatorships or all kind of center-left presidents. And now we have a continent that's split angularly down the middle, and the image is quite stark. You have Brazil and you have Mexico, and those are the two bulwarks of Latin America. And ultimately, if you're going to get Latin America under control and back under the U.S.'s umbrella, you have to confront those two countries. Ultimately, that is the end goal. And this is in the larger context of a dramatic reversal of U.S. foreign policy, the total renunciation of liberal internationalism. Now, liberal internationalism as an ideal, there was a big gap between in practice and as it actually functioned. But the idea was that the United States would superintend a world governed by common laws. The Trump administration announced in its national security strategy document, which it put out last week or a couple of weeks ago, that the bipartisan consensus that came out of the Cold War has failed. And it had been essentially announced implicitly that what it sees as replacing it is a Monroe Doctrine for the entire world. The way the United States acted with impunity to seize, to kill, and to sanction, it could do anywhere.
Which brings us to what Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth just said at the Reagan Defense Forum. He said, quote, the Monroe Doctrine is in effect.
After years of neglect, the United States will restore U.S. military dominance in the Western Hemisphere. We will use it to protect our homeland and access to key terrain throughout the region. We will also deny adversaries' ability to position forces or other threatening capabilities in our hemisphere. Past administrations perpetuated the belief that the Monroe Doctrine had expired. They were wrong. The Monroe Doctrine is in effect, and it is stronger than ever under the Trump corollary. A common sense restoration of our power and prerogatives in this hemisphere consistent with U.S. interests.
No, that was Defense Secretary Hegseth. I wanted to ask you, though, Greg, Latin America is not the same region that it was 100 years ago or that it was 50 years ago. And when you mentioned this split in the region, I'm not so sure I agree with you on that. Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia are the three largest nations in Latin America. They have half the population of the entire region. And all three of those countries are being led still by progressive, left-wing oriented presidents. None of them are going to back a U.S. Invasion, not to mention some of the smaller countries like Cuba or Nicaragua. And so we're in a situation where the United States is trying to impose a past that no longer exists. I'm wondering what you think, even if the intervention were to occur, and it seems likely that's going to happen just in time to eclipse any news of the release of the Epstein files, the ability of the United States to impose its chosen leader on Venezuela is going to be severely restricted, not only by the international condemnation, but also by the fact that the Venezuelan military has been politicized directly over years now as a result of the Chavez revolution. So they're not likely just to lay down their arms and allow the U.S. to come in.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And that's what I meant, that the region was split, and that in Mexico and Brazil, if they're not isolated, then there is no kind of broader U.S. hegemony over the region. And certainly Colombia also, although there's elections coming up in Colombia, and that country is going to be in play. But I think Mexico and Brazil are secure for now. But yes, and then speaking about Venezuela, it's unclear what the actual action is going to be. I mean, it's just stopping. It's the sanction and blockade on the oil tankers are going to put enormous pressure on Venezuela to, in terms of food, in terms of being able to import food and feed its people and what kind of disaster that's going to be. The sanctions are already incredibly punishing. That was bipartisan consensus going back decades to even Obama. We might see some massive show of force, some targeted strikes, but you're absolutely right. Venezuela is not Libya. It's not going to collapse. I think there is
a kind of embedded structure that on the one hand there is a radicalized sector of the population, on the other hand there are there are people invested in a kind of militarized corruption that does structure some of the ways the country is governed. And Maduro could or could not go, but that doesn't necessarily mean the United States is going to have its way and just be able to install a puppet like it did in Chile in 73 or Guatemala in 54 or any number of coups in the past. It's a dangerous game. I was sitting out in the waiting room today and just now, a second ago, and CNN talked about a second-year crash between a private jet and some U.S. military force. I mean, they're really pushing it to the max. Of course, these murders and on the high seas. Now we have an admission from the administration that this is just, this has nothing to do with drugs. It has everything to do with Maduro. These are innocent people. It's like he's like the Red Queen in Alice. You execute, then you have the trial, and then you have the conviction, and then you have the trial. he does everything backwards. We're living in like an Alice in Wonderland foreign policy in Latin America. But Latin America is confused. There's tension within Latin America. Petro said that he wouldn't shake President-elect Castro's hand. This is a Nazi, and he was immediately rebuked by Boris, a center-leftist. So there's also a lot of tension within Latin America about how to respond to the United States. That kind of unity that existed coming out of the 2000s, Chavez, when Chavez was president and Lula was the president of Brazil, and you had Kirchner in Argentina, and you had Bachelet in Chile, and it was a very rhetorically strong and dominant form of social democracy that really commanded the rhetorical field. I think what we're seeing here is a lot of
a lot of confusion about how to deal with Trump, just like the rest of the world. It is in some ways the madman doctrine of diplomacy, except the madman doctrine was supposed to be a performance, an act. But we actually have a madman in the White House in some ways.
Well, but the issue is clearly the key aspect of this in Venezuela that distinguishes Venezuela from all the other governments that in the region that that Trump may not like is these vast oil reserves. Yeah. That on the one hand, can you talk about the importance of these oil reserves and also the fact that the American people, by and large, all the polls indicate they have no interest in the United States launching a war against Venezuela because Venezuela has not posed any threat to the United States.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And it's I think that's one of the reasons why it's taking Trump so long to figure out what to do. He may be a madman, but he's not completely irrational. He does calculate. And there is obviously no bloodthirst within the rank and file of the Trump administration for a ground war in Venezuela. And certainly not within the country as a whole. And so he's responding to that. Then there's the calculus of, well, distraction, the Epstein files. Will this distract or will people make the connection that we're doing it to distract? And, you know, there's a lot of independent, we've heard about how the Republican ecosphere, information sphere is kind of fracturing and coming apart and eating each other. Venezuela does have oil, but, you know, there's lots of ways of getting Venezuela's oil. I mean, Maduro is basically offered it up. Chevron, as we speak, is pumping oil and sending it to Port Arthur in Texas to be processed. There's lots of ways to get control. It doesn't. So a war with Venezuela over oil is an ideological war, and it's led by the Marco Rubio faction, the war party within the Trump administration, that sees Latin America in very ideological terms, in which Venezuela is the first step to contain a left that, yes, is still strong and still, you know, has quite a purchase. I mean, even in Chile, right, 42% of the population voted for a communist woman. In one of the most socially conservative countries in Latin America. That's not nothing. I mean, it's a shame we got the Nazi, but, you know, 42% of the country voted for Jeanette Jara, who is, you know, a communist woman. That's that speaks, I think, to the strength of the ongoing strength of the left. But there isn't a coherent strategy of how to deal with the United States. I mean, any country going to come to Venezuela's aid to try to get the oil out? I don't think Colombia can risk that. You know, there are ways in which you can imagine Colombia trying to get Venezuela's oil out of it, but do they want to provoke the United States to that degree? It's a little unclear. So I think everything's up in the air and on the table at this moment. Anything can happen, and I guess things will be clarified by the speech or not.
Well, Greg Grandin, we want to thank you for being with us. Yale University history professor, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His latest book, America, America, A New History of the New World. And we'll link to your piece in the New York Times headline, Trump's Dated Strategy is Putting Us on a Path to World War III. We'll link to you at democracynow.org. Coming up, Chile has elected its most right-wing president since Augusto Pinochet. We'll go to Santiago to speak with the renowned Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman. This is Democracy Now! We'll also later in the broadcast look at the untold story of how Jeffrey Epstein got rich. Back in 30 seconds.
Una canción de amor esta noche. Inesperada para mi voz. Una canción de amor y de goce. Una canción de amor de los dos. Una canción chorubiada. Una canción choroboriada. Una canción chorubiada. Una canción
Una Canción, a song by the Cuban musician Silvio Rodriguez, performing at New York Central Park years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Chile. Looking at the election of José Antonio Kast, who's set to become Chile's most right-wing leader since the U.S.-backed dictator Augusto Pinochet. In Sunday's election, Kast won about 58% of the vote, defeating Jeanette Jara, a member of the Communist Party. She'd served as labor minister under outgoing Chilean President Gabriel Boric, who was not eligible to run for re-election. Kast once praised Pinochet, saying, quote, "If he were alive, he would vote for me," unquote. On Tuesday, Kast traveled to Buenos Aires to meet with Argentina's far-right president, Javier Milei. We go now to Santiago, where we're joined by Ariel Dorfman, the acclaimed Chilean-American novelist, playwright, essayist, academic, and human rights activist, distinguished professor emeritus of literature at Duke University in North Carolina. Ariel Dorfman served as a cultural advisor to Salvador Allende from 1970 to 1973. After the U.S.-backed military coup that installed dictator Augusto Pinochet, Ariel Dorfman fled Chile and went into exile. Today, he's recognized as one of Latin America's greatest writers. His essays, novels, poems, plays have been translated into more than 40 languages. And he has a new article in The New York Times headlined, "Chile's Election is More Than Just a Swerve to the Right." Thanks so much for being with us, Ariel Dorfman. Explain the significance of Chile's election today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Amy. And it's a pleasure to be on Democracy Now!, especially when Democracy Now! Is in such danger in Chile and around the world. There has been, since democracy was restored in 1990, we have had basically center-left governments, except for two occasions, which is of Sebastián Piñera. And Sebastián Piñera twice was elected president, but he could be understood as a moderate conservative. What made it possible for him to be elected in Chile over his 35 years, eight years of the 35 years, is that he voted against Pinochet remaining in power in the referendum of 1988. In that referendum of 1988, a young 22-year-old student called José Antonio Kast appeared on television saying how he adored the general and hoped that he would remain in power forever. Now, that same man, who since then has accumulated a series of more outrageous statements still, is going to be the next president of this country. In other words, a land that got rid of General Pinochet, that danced in the streets when Pinochet died in 2006. That man is now going to be the president of this country. It is a political and ethical earthquake because there are, I mean, I can just go on and on about what this man means. He is going to assault the network that has been constructed not in the last 35 years, but in the last 100 years. The economic and social rights of workers, the indigenous rights. He's against abortion, even if the mother's life is in danger. He's against gay couples, obviously. I could just go on and on and on about this man, whose father, by the way, was a Nazi himself. He was in 1942, joined the Nazi Party as an officer in the Wehrmacht of Germany. And then he, under false papers, arrived in Chile. So it's very strange, you know, because Kast has based his campaign on an anti-immigrant agenda. And according to that agenda, his father would be expelled right now because he arrived undocumented to Santiago.
Well, but Ariel, to what do you attribute the majority of the Chilean people voting for him? And also, to what degree do you think he'll be able to implement that program? He still needs support in the Chilean government as well, among the elected deputies of that country.
So let's go first to your first question, which is, by the way, he won 58%, not 50% of the vote. 58%, which is an enormous majority in Chile, more than 16 points more than Janet Jara, who was his adversary. But the point about this is that the major problems that Chileans constantly are speaking about is too much immigration, enormous amount of crime, though the crime is not linked to immigrants, as the right wing will say. It's mostly Chileans against Chileans, but it doesn't matter. That's their message, and people are buying it. And the problem of affordability. But, you know, Kast would not be able to have this victory, this significant victory, in which a series of people who are not necessarily against democracy want security in their lives. They want somebody strong, like Bukele in El Salvador, in fact, you know, because that's one of the things. Kast has had advisors from Bukele, the Salvadorian despot, to build maximum security prisons here and do away basically with habeas corpus and other forms of democratic institutions. So Kast would not have been able to fill this void if the center-left had not, over many, many years, in some senses, turned its back on the troubles of the people. I want to mention here, because I think I had mentioned this before when I spoke about coming on the program, in my novel, The Suicide Museum, there's a long section, several chapters, on the year 1990. All of it happens in the year 1990, which is the year of the transition from dictatorship to democracy. And I focus on the moment when Allende, Salvador Allende, is taken from his anonymous tomb and given a state funeral in Santiago. I was there. I was part of that. I was living there at the moment. And what called my attention, and I mentioned in the novel, The Suicide Museum, is that the elite was inside the cemetery and in the cathedral where Allende was being buried. But all the people, the young people, the women, the workers, the peasants, the students, everybody who had given their lives and fought for 17 years against Pinochet, those people were left outside. They were even tear gassed, in other words, so because they wanted also to give a homage to their president, their dead president. The people who had made it possible for Allende to be buried in democracy, for democracy to be returned to Chile, were sort of left out. I found this symbolic. It's not that in 35 years, many good things were not done. You know, poverty was diminished significantly. Infrastructure was major. Major things were done in indigenous rights. Major things were done in sexual rights and reproductive rights. So there have been very, very big advances in that sense. But it's been insufficient. And I think that there is a need for the center-left and the left in general to look very carefully at what blindness or mistakes or fractures they have allowed in the past, and ask themselves what they need to do to reimagine the country in a different way, to think of the country as a different project. You know, I found that one of the things that I found in Chile this last month and a half that we've been here is there's a sense where people are detached. They're uneasy. I call it malestar in my article in today's New York Times. Malestar meaning they don't feel well with themselves. They're a bit sick. They're a bit unhinged. They don't feel that things are going well. And so, of course, they'll say, well, somebody offers us security. They offer us a clear solution, even if it means, you know, getting rid of some democratic institutions. Well, let's be secure at last. Let's not have criminals roaming the streets. I hardly know of anybody who has not had some sort of assault, a criminal assault of some sort. Not all narco-trafficking, but a lot of that, right? So people are fed up with that and tired of that. And the left has not given them a solution. And this is not, I think, only the case in Chile. I think it's the case worldwide. The rise of authoritarianism is only possible because we, who want a just and equal society, who do not want to continue with exploitation and super millionaires deciding everything for us, and climate apocalypse, because Kast, of course, is getting rid of all the watchdogs on climate change, right? We want to make sure that those people who are decent, progressive people, and who are, I think, the great majority, find a way of expressing themselves in something that inspires the people. I don't find my people here inspired. I find them angry, confused, sad, with malestar, with that sense of unease and malaise everywhere almost, right? There's still, you know, there's still a great deal of joy in the people. But I think that in the referendum of 1988, the people of Chile, in the worst circumstances, they managed to defeat the dictator, even if the dictator had. This is the way when Cast was for Pinochet and Piñera, the moderate conservative, was against him. In that election, the people of Chile rejected that possibility of Pinochet staying in power. And that is why I have some hope as well. I feel as if that joy was demobilized, that struggle, that sense of participation, of protagonism that was possible all during the dictatorship. From 1988, especially until 1990, it was stopped. In some sense, it was said, go home, produce, consume, be happy, and just leave the governing to us, instead of saying, let's continue the mobilization. You know, when Pinochet was commander-in-chief during in democracy even, he put his troops on alert because he was being investigated. Instead of calling the people into the streets and saying, we are stopping this country, stop it. You're not in charge of General Pinochet anymore. They said, go home, don't worry, we'll take care of things. So it's been compromise after compromise, and it's been too many. And I think people, therefore, are uninspired, basically. And if you have an uninspired left, an uninspired people, they will tend to, the void will happen in that sense. You know, I have a metaphor for this, by the way. The reason why I think that Cast is in trouble, and may be in trouble in the future. First of all, I think he's not going to be able to put he wants to get rid of hundreds of thousands of civil servants because they're parasites, according to his advisors. He wants to deport 330,000 undocumented immigrants. He wants to build a wall, of course. I mean, he wants to finish with all the transgender rights and the gay rights and the women's rights, a series of things. But apart from that, it turns out that he wants to erase the country's history. He wants to get rid of the story of what the coup was about and what the coup engendered. He wants his hero, Pinochet, once again to be venerated by all. He wants to forget the concentration camps and the executions and the torture and the exiles and all the terrible things that have been memorialized in this time. I think that there's a saying, I like this saying, I was thinking of it as I was thinking about Cast, you know. It says, an African proverb says, the axe forgets, but the tree remembers. And I think this is true in Chile. I think the dead of Chile remember. I think the survivors of Pinochet remember. I think many people in Chile remember. I think, I know this is, I mean, I'm a writer, I'm a novelist, I'm a poet. So I think there's a lyrical sense to this, which is, the Cast presidency will be haunted by what it tries to suppress. It will come out from all the trees of Chile. I think Chile is a forest of resistance. We are a minority now for the moment. We are taking our time. It's 42%. It can be more. It doesn't matter how many you are, really. It matters that in the streets, people will not allow a regression of this sort. And if Cast wants to throw the army into this to try to repress the people as happened in the past, because the story of Chile is a story of massacres of peasants and workers and students for 100 years now. If Cast wants to do that, he may find that there is a recalcitrant army. The army already went through the shame of having been the pawn of Pinochet's dictatorship. They do not want it anymore. And when there was the estallido, the explosion of hundreds of thousands of Chileans who were fed up, this time from the left, let's say, right, and almost brought down the government, Piñera, who was then president before Boric, Piñera asked the armed forces to police the streets. And the general in charge of the armed forces says, we are not policemen. That is not what we do. And this is a very big change, right? So let us see what's going to happen as Cast tries to impose a neoliberal model on a country that has, in fact, in the polls, consistently said that it's against so many millionaires having so much money, so much inequality, so much injustice. But people want control over their lives. And they can't have control over their lives if they feel that there's a security threat next door to them and that things will happen which they can't control, their own neighborhoods in that sense, right?
Ariel, so we have 20 seconds.
We're up against a very special moment. I'm sorry, yes.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Ariel Dorfman, acclaimed Chilean-American writer. We're going to link to your New York Times op-ed, Chile's election is more than just a swerve to the right. Coming up, scams, schemes, ruthless cons, the untold story of how Jeffrey Epstein got rich. Stay with us.
Yo puedo ser tu hermana, tu hija, Tamara, Pamela, Valentina. Yo puedo ser tu gran amiga, incluso tu compañera de vida. Yo puedo ser tu gran aliada, la que aconseja y la que apaña. Yo puedo ser cualquiera de todas, depende de cómo tú me apodas. Pero no voy a ser la que obedece, porque mi cuerpo me pertenece. Yo decido de mi tiempo, cuando quiero y dónde quiero. Independiente yo nací, independiente decidí. Yo no camino detrás de ti, yo camino de la para aquí. Tú no me vas a humillar, tú no me vas a gritar, tú no me vas a someter, tú no me vas a callar, tú no me vas a denigrar, tú no me vas a golpear, tú no me vas a denigrar.
Anti-patriarca, anti-patriarchy by the Chilean musician Ana Tijoux, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Friday's the deadline for the Department of Justice to release its investigative files into the dead financier and serial sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. The deadline was set with the passage of the Epstein Transparency Act last month. One of the questions that's remained largely unanswered until now is, how did Jeffrey Epstein become so extravagantly wealthy? Wealth that both enabled his crimes and shielded him from scrutiny and accountability for so many years. Well, a new investigation by the New York Times uncovered details about Epstein's rise previously unreported and provides an answer. The investigation's headline, Scams, Schemes, Ruthless Cons, the untold story of how Jeffrey Epstein got rich. This is a video clip featuring some of the reporters. It begins with business reporter Jessica Silver Greenberg.
How did Jeffrey Epstein have the financial backing to abuse what turns out to be hundreds of young women and girls?
The hundreds of millions of dollars that Epstein amassed, the palatial estates and aircraft.
Connections to some of the wealthiest, most established people all over the world. There's been a tremendous number of conspiracy theories and myths.
From he was running a huge blackmail operation to he was affiliated with spy agencies.
Through months of reporting and digging through documents,
people's diaries, letters, old photo albums.
The answer is he stole it.
He stole it. The New York Times investigation begins with Epstein in his early 20s, a college dropout teaching math at the prestigious Dalton High School here in New York. He's introduced by a student's father to Ace Greenberg, the future chief executive of Bear Stearns, an introduction that changed Epstein's life. For more, we're joined by New York Times deputy investigations editor David Enrich, who co-wrote the new piece. We thank you so much for being with us, joining us from Dobbs Ferry. Can you name names, lay out Jeffrey Epstein's rise, the critical importance of the people he connected with, and the lies, the thievery, all that you lay out after, what, months, years of this investigation?
Yeah, we've spent a long time on this one, and it really starts at Bear Stearns, where Epstein is introduced to a guy named Ace Greenberg, who was a top executive at the investment firm. And Greenberg and another of his colleagues, Jimmy Kane, who's also a top executive there, took Epstein under their wings and made him their protege. And Epstein proceeded to go on kind of this spree of wrongdoing at Bear Stearns. Everything from abusing his expense account, lying on his resume, giving a girlfriend early access to kind of hot investment deals. And time again, Epstein's protectors at the bank went to bat for him and basically got him out of trouble. And this was the start of a lifelong pattern for Epstein, where he would push the envelope, cross ethical, moral, sometimes legal lines, and basically escape with impunity because of his really astounding ability to charm people in positions of power and to use his leverage over people in positions of power. And one of the things we heard about Bear Stearns was that he was, and this was a time in the late 70s and early 80s where there was a lot of drugs and sex going on within the firm itself. And Epstein, it sounds like, was providing some of the top executives with drugs and with access to women. And so, you know, he had leverage and he was not afraid to use the leverage. And again, we see this over and over and over again in the ensuing decades of Epstein's life and career.
And David, one of the key figures that he cultivated was the Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz. Could you talk about how they got together and the importance of Dershowitz in his rise?
Yeah, and Dershowitz is interesting because he is both, and he goes on to become Epstein's kind of leading defender and leading protector, but Epstein connects with him through by doing this thing that he does all the time, which is he leverages one connection to form another, to form another. And so in the case of Dershowitz, Epstein in the early 90s had become close with a woman named Lynn Forrester, who was this successful telecom executive who was very close to Bill Clinton and the Clinton White House. Epstein befriends her. She is friends with Dershowitz. And Forrester asks Epstein asks Dershowitz if Epstein can come over and visit him. So Epstein and Dershowitz get together on Martha's Vineyard, and Epstein convinces Dershowitz to fly out to Ohio with Epstein for a birthday party for Les Wexner, who is the billionaire retail tycoon who owns brands like Victoria's Secret. And this is the start of a years-long and very fruitful relationship for both Epstein and Dershowitz. And Dershowitz gets a lot of notoriety and, I think from his perspective, probably fame from his representation of Epstein. And Epstein, for his part, gets this access to a world-class lawyer who engineers a sweetheart deal for him in around 2007 that gets him basically out of trouble when he was facing a sex trafficking and money laundering investigation in Florida. And Dershowitz, and to this day, is one of Epstein's leading public defenders. And so it was an investment that Epstein made in this man in a very kind of prescient way early on. And that entailed not just introducing him to people, but also getting him access to invest in very exclusive hedge funds. And when those investments didn't work out, getting Dershowitz bailed out of those investments. So Epstein was just absolutely masterful at leveraging one connection to benefit another. And, you know, it's often been said that Epstein is this math genius and this super sophisticated financier. What we found in our reporting is much simpler, which is that he may have been those things, but the evidence shows that what made a difference for him in the long run was his ability to charm and entrance and leverage powerful people off of one another.
And if you can talk about the connections, as we're about to see the documents released, if we are, Friday, December 19th, the connections to Trump, to Robert Maxwell, the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, to Ghislaine Maxwell herself serving a 20-year sentence for sex trafficking. Go ahead, David.
Well, and we don't know what's going to be in these files, if indeed there are files released by Friday. And I think it is much more likely, I don't think it's very likely that we're going to see a lot of stuff that kind of plumbs through Epstein's ancient history the way we did in this article. That's part of the reason we wanted to do this reporting, was to provide, kind of shine a light on a phase in his life that has not undergone quite as much scrutiny as his later years. And I think what we're likely to see in these files is quite a bit about him in the 2000s, essentially, and in 2010s. And that happens to be a period where he certainly overlapped with Donald Trump for a period. He overlapped with Bill Clinton for a period. And there are a lot of powerful, important figures kind of darting in and out of his life. And obviously, there is an enormous amount of interest, rightly so, in what these files show, if anything, about how Epstein's sex trafficking operation ensnared some of these kind of bold-faced names. The truth is, and I'm not trying to be coy or evade the question. We just really have no idea what is in these files and what is going to actually be released in a way that is legible. And I think there is an expectation or a concern that these might be very, very heavily redacted if they get released at all. And hopefully I'm wrong about that, because I think the whole world is clamoring for some transparency here. And I, just as someone who's been covering this for like six plus years now with my colleagues at the Times, we are really eager to see what's in these files.
And finally, what surprised you most as you investigated him for all of these years? We just have 30 seconds.
I think what surprised me the most was just how pedestrian some of his scams were. This is not someone who is hatching this like extremely elaborate plot to con sophisticated people through this, all these like bells and whistles. He was just grabbing people's money and running with it. And for all of the attention that's been paid to the possibility of Epstein being part of spy services or running this really sophisticated blackmail operation, the truth that we found, and there may be more to it, but what we found was much more run-of-the-mill and kind of low-level than that.
David Enrich, we want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Investigations Editor for The New York Times. We'll link to your new investigation, Scams, Schemes, Ruthless Cons, The Untold Story of How